The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On today's pod, England's World Cup winning squad is announced by some kids rapping on a double-decker bus. Time's up for Allardyce and Moyes. Is the age of old-school football manager dead until midway through next season when someone else panics? Atletico win the Europa League final in Lyon. Antoine Griezmann shows how to finish, while Clinton and G really doesn't. We'll look ahead to the FA Cup final, sort out the playoffs, take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Have a panel today. Barry Glendenning, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You look marvellous.
Great. I've had a haircut.
You have? Makes your head look a little fatter. I didn't mean it like that.
What way did you mean it? It's not a very ambiguous thing to say.
No, you look streamlined and hot.
Thank you.
Hey, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
I'm good.
Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you.
Anything
too.
You want to tell us?
It's Norway Day today.
It's Norwegian Constitution Day.
Norway Day. I'm calling it that.
And what happens on Norway Day?
We do big parades and eat ice cream.
You dress as Vikings?
No, it's suit or bunad.
Suit or what?
Bunad, which is a sort of Norwegian traditional dress.
I was told you dressed as Viking. I was given false information.
Yeah, that's very false information. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you can dress as Viking, but you look like a complete weirdo and people will think there's something wrong with you.
Hey, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Straight from Lyon. Did you have a nice time? And we don't go into the game, because that's not for this part.
Well, I had an hour and three quarters sleep last night.
Okay. Because you were partying with Fernando Torres?
Talking about Lord of the Rings again.
Were you?
No.
Was I?
I've told that story a million times.
Do you know what? It may possibly be one of the times when I completely zone out. Who knows? Hey, let's start with the England squad. It was announced, as I said, by lots of children sort of rapping and screaming noises, which is good for the young people. We'll get on to that, but we should probably talk about the squad itself. Gareth Southgate has named his squad of 23. I'm not going to read all the names out because you probably know them by now. If you don't, go to the Guardian website. Some of the headlines: no Joe Hart, no Jack Wilshere, Ruben Loftus-Cheek is in, Trent Alexander-Arnold is in without playing a game, Adam Lallana makes the standby list, Fabian Delph is in as well. Jonathan, your thoughts?
It's, I guess, as much as expected, isn't it? I mean, the only name that sort of stands out as being, I wasn't expecting him to be there, is Danny Welbeck, but he's always done well for England. I don't think he's had a pretty good season, but I can see why he's a useful player to have. You know, his pace gives you another dimension. His ability to cut in from the left might be useful. And you know, his England record is very good. So when you start to ask yourself, well, who else would you have in there instead? Lallana, I guess, is the obvious replacement, but he just hasn't played. So, yeah, Southgate has been very clear. He wants people who are playing regularly. So that all makes sense.
Barry, you've been banging the drum for Joe Hart for a long time.
Well, I haven't.
No, I don't know what the opposite of banging a drum is.
But not banging a drum.
You have not been banging the drum vociferously for Joe Hart for a while. It's not a surprise, is he?
No, look, if he had gone, it would have been his third choice and he almost certainly wouldn't have played, barring a couple of calamities. So it's no big surprise that he's not included. I think he's very annoyed. His people have certainly let certain journalists in their favour know that Hart blames David Moyes for his omission, which is kind of depressing to hear, really, because Joe Hart has no one to blame for his own decline but himself. And it has been a staggeringly quick decline, and it'll be interesting to see how he bounces back from this, or if he bounces back from it. His initial reaction to being left out, claiming it's someone else's fault, would suggest he may not bounce back from it.
It's important to remember this with Joe Hart, that he was a brilliant goalkeeper, and he's only 31, I think. He has the capacity to be great again, doesn't he?
He does, but I would say it's unlikely. I think we've seen the best of him. It would be rare for someone in his position to come back from... Sorry, what's so funny?
Producer Jonathan just wrote, make Joe Hart great again. We get hats and
should
everything.
Should we, though?
Could Joe Hart be great again?
It's possible, but I think it's unlikely. You know, keepers, when they go into decline, tend not to bounce back. It has been known to happen. It's difficult to know where he'll go next because he's obviously doesn't seem to have a future at West Ham. He's no future at Manchester City. And I don't know who would want him, really. Maybe a spell in the Championship or another trip abroad. But it sort of seems like life abroad didn't really suit him at Torino. But that's just no reason why he shouldn't try going somewhere else again.
England's third youngest squad for a World Cup. 26 years and 18 days, the average, Lars. Are we too experienced? Are we too inexperienced?
But I think the uplifting thing is that what's often been the case with these England squads is that the manager has kind of defaulted back on the big names and the players from the biggest clubs when push has come to shove. And in this case, it seems like Gareth Southgate has a couple of overriding priorities. He wants players who are physically very fit. He wants players who can look after the ball. And for that reason, Wilshere and Lallana have a lot going for them, but fitness-wise, you can't really rely on them, and so he's not taking them. Smalling, again, can be a good defender and plays for a big club, but maybe not great with the ball, so he's not taking them. And it's, I don't think there's any doubt that these are the 23 men that Gareth Southgate really wants to have, rather than a couple of big names in there who he's put in just because they're big names, and I think that's a good thing.
Jonathan, who's our goalkeeper going to be then? Pickford?
I would assume so, yeah. And I think that's partly, yeah, he's just a very good goalkeeper in a traditional sense, but he's also really good with the ball at his feet. And one of the features of Sunderland's relegation season from the Premier League was, yeah, in fact, the only good thing of that season was him smacking 70-yard balls at Jermaine Defoe's head. But they were really accurate, and had Jermaine Defoe been 6'4" rather than 4'6",
that would have hit him in the chest.
Yeah.
The defence, we are going to play a three, right? Do you, Lars, think that actually that's the right thing for England to be playing?
Yeah, sure, because it's the thing you've been doing for a while now. It's the thing you've been working on. I think it's important to remember with international football is that he has such a limited time together as a squad. So it's important to decide on a way to play and give the players a couple of international breaks to work on that, and then suddenly changing that ahead of a tournament would be bizarre. So this is what they've been working on, so this is what they should be doing. Given that they have some pretty good attacking fullbacks, not a whole heap of good wingers, yeah, it does seem to make sense to play that way.
Yeah, and I like the idea of the two inside forwards, so the, you know, the 3-4-2-1. I think we saw with Chelsea last season that those two can be quite difficult for opponents to pick up. I think in the Premier League, I mean, partly to do with Chelsea regressing and partly teams sort of working it out, at international level, maybe teams are not well enough drilled to deal with that. And, you know, it requires an adjustment on your part to have these players are not wingers, they're not in the middle, they're sort of in between, and that can be quite difficult. I think the one issue, the one problem, is a perennial problem for all top 10, top 12 sides at World Cups of England fall in that bracket, is the back three, I think, will work against good sides. It might be a bit stodgy against Panama and Tunisia, and I think we just have to accept those will be grim games. And if England can get out of them with 2-1-0 wins, that is absolutely fine. But obviously people will go mad and get very frustrated by those two matches.
So we'll panic, go mad, and then we'll move to a back four for the Belgium game?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's all panning out already, Lars.
I guess the thing you're a bit short on, but there's no fix for this, is that you don't really have a central midfielder who's great at passing the ball around and distributing the play. But there just isn't anyone. Like, there's been this call for Shelvey, which I think is just sort of a cry for help because people realise that there just isn't anyone, and Shelvey's like the closest thing.
And I think that's why Wilshere has been so indulged for so long, that if he were fit, if he had become the player he looked like he might be 6 or 7 years ago, he would have been ideal for that, and people have given him every chance to be that, but unfortunately his body keeps letting him down. And you're right, there just isn't one.
It's worth, just not that we're having it here, but just to put the Shelvey debate that seems to exist to bed, is that while he's absolutely capable of playing the odd sort of raking ball and nice through ball that looks not great on Match of the Day, he also gives it away a lot of the time. Like, and that's to do with the role he has for Newcastle, of course. But his pass completion this season for Newcastle is like 72% or something, which for a central midfielder...
He is passing to Dwight Gayle.
Oh. Yeah.
It is a debate that you just can't not hear about England's central midfield. They only have... There's only really sort of three central midfielders there, I think. Also, Loftus-Cheek as well. Henderson, Dyer, Loftus-Cheek, and Delph. In those two, I mean, can you play Ali or Lingard deeper? Or?
I think against Panama and Tunisia, there's a case to be made that you drop Ali a bit deeper and play Lingard or something instead of him behind the striker. I think that makes sense.
I actually have my England team here.
Here we go.
Dele Alli's there, and there's an arrow pointing towards deep. So, yeah.
Okay, let's have it. Let's have Barry's England team.
Pickford, Walker, Stones, Maguire, Trippier, Henderson, Ali, Rose, Lingard, Sterling, Kane.
I think against Panama and Tunisia, that's probably what it'll look like. And I think against Belgium and then, is it Colombia or Poland probably in the next game, it would be Henderson and Dyer in the middle.
But there's a huge panic about Henderson and Dyer. There's a huge... It's impossible to play them together. Football is ruined.
I mean, Tottenham have won a bunch of games playing Dyer and Wanyama. Like, there's no sort of... there's no Pirlo in that midfield. So
Henderson... he's not a sort of Xavi-style passer, but his passing is actually quite good. His long passing is very good. He's a really good... He started off as a right winger. He's a very good crossover ball as well. So, yeah, Henderson's not a brilliant passer, but he's an okay passer. I think the other change for the tougher games might be Walker going to right wing back in a more sort of orthodox central defender coming in, but... Yeah, I agree entirely what you say about the midfield.
One thing, I think, looking at this squad, like I'm personally a big believer that players are completely entitled to play for whichever country they feel like they should be playing for. It's a deeply personal decision when you have a split nationality, and I would never criticise anyone for making any decision. But you just look at the squad and you think, if Zaha was still eligible, like not only would he be in the squad, but I think he'd had a fair shout at playing in quite a few games this summer, because what he brings, England could really use.
I have a feeling, and I could be totally wrong, but I have a feeling Zaha could have been persuaded to play for England, but chose not to, possibly because he felt he wasn't going to get an opportunity. But anyway, it's neither here nor there because he's made his decision.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make, Jonathan, about how we box players. So Henderson and Dyer cannot pass the ball. So Dyer put that ball over for Ali against Chelsea, which was technically a very hard pass to play, 60 yards in a straight line, and it was a beautiful pass. And we're just totally guilty, not just with this squad, but just with footballers in general, of saying this is what they do and they're incapable of either improving or not doing what we say they can't do.
Well, I think we are, but I think there's also, there is a point about passing. It's not just about the technical ability to play the pass. It's about having the mental awareness to play the pass quickly and the confidence to play the pass under pressure. And perhaps that's where Dyer and Henderson are a little slower than a really, really high-class passing central midfielder. But yeah, I do think that We perhaps pigeonhole people. I'm still in this tactics pigeon. I've been trying to get out for 10 years.
I'm just a banter merchant, Jonathan. Think yourself lucky.
I have breakfast, I guess. No,
I have nothing.
Yeah, you've got dour misery, Barry.
Jonathan thinks he's more dour and miserable than I am. He gets upset because I get credited for being the dour and miserable one.
But that's sad for you because Jonathan's got tactics.
I know.
He's better at doing what you do than you do it.
No, but you do it well because you speak really slowly. And that, I think, is something on which I should work.
Very good.
Now you know how it feels, Barry. Lars, I think you were making a point about football.
Well, what I'd like to think is when you're going at a tournament like this, we have to remember we're actually not playing that many games, and you can kind of predict what games you're going to be playing. Historically, England sort of scrape out of the group stages and then get knocked out by the first decent team they come up against.
Well, that used to be the case. We kill for that now.
Or Iceland, yeah. But we certainly know for the group stages, we know we're going to play two games where a high likelihood is that England's going to have a lot of possession but might struggle a bit to break down the opponent. And it's in those two games, the Panama and Tunisia games, where you look at this team and you would like some guy in there who's slightly better at picking the lock than perhaps the midfielders you've got. But you look around the Premier League and, again, there aren't that many options. Like, I don't... Like, you're suddenly in, like, Tom Carroll territory, and it's not... That would be weird. So there's a shortage of good passing midfielders. That's just the way it is.
Oh, to be in Tom Carroll territory. There were nice reactions on social media. Marcus Rashford put a picture of his mum, saying, "Thanks, mum, for ferrying me to football." Ashley Young wearing the Mexico 86 shirt as a kid. Harry Maguire from 2 years ago saying...
Ashley Young was born in 1985. He was, yes, on the 9th of July, 1985.
Okay. I've got a worrying feeling Wilson knows the birthdays of every footballer that's ever been. Harry Maguire.
I don't. But you know why I know Ashley Young's.
Why would
birthday?
I know why you know Ashley
because
Young's birthday?
Because in Belfast,
yeah,
I was introduced as somebody who shared a birthday with Ashley Young.
Okay.
And also both the two lads who were twins, who were Manchester United.
Fabio
and the other one.
Yeah.
What are they called?
Raphael.
And Donatello. happy birthday for that day.
Oh, thanks.
This is from other nice pictures. Harry Maguire from 2 years ago when he was out with his mates supporting England in the Euros. I would have thought that'd be enough.
Was he throwing bottles around a town square?
I don't know. But you'd have thought if you went to the Iceland game, it'd be enough to retire from international football before you've even made it. Johnny says, can you give me some quick facts about Jadon Sancho so that I can pretend to be outraged at his non-inclusion in the England squad? I found this for you from Sam Cunningham in the iPaper. It says, Sancho would give British sprinters a run for their money in the 100 metres and has more tricks than Dynamo. So there you go. You can use them. Interesting.
But are those tricks useful on a football pitch is the question.
Here's a chicken. I'm suddenly in a box. You never know, actually. Here's an Ashley Young stat from Duncan Alexander from Opta. I haven't seen Dynamo's latest series.
I think he's ill at the moment.
Yeah, he isn't well, is he? Duncan Alexander from Opta says, Ashley Young is the first player called Young to be the oldest player in a World Cup squad since Choi Young-il in 1998.
Wow.
Players in the England squad with 40-plus caps at the time of the squad announcement in the last five World Cups. 7 in 2002, 8 in 2006, 8 in 2010, 6 in 2014 and 1 in 2018. Who is?
Henderson.
Gary Cahill.
Cahill.
Who we don't think will start.
Does probably not. Start? I mean,
I would say it's unlikely. But he may well get a run out at some point.
Did you like the way the squad was announced?
No. My toes curled. I suspect I wasn't the target audience, but that's not the kind of behaviour I see from young people on buses.
If you haven't seen it, basically it pans to various youths shouting the names of the players who've made the squad, including someone holding a phone with Alexander Arnold on, presumably because he was quite a late pick and they hadn't filmed that bit. Each bit, I think, is filmed in like the place they were born or they're from. So, I can't remember. Kane's from Chingford or something. So it's youth from those areas. I'm with you, Barry. I thought it was, if somebody had asked me and you to make a video of what we thought kids might like,
yes, we'd make that. That's what we would do.
But then you see other, you know, some people have said, oh, I quite like it. Aren't the FA being forward thinking? Similar people to people our age. I don't know. I maybe it wasn't for us. I don't want to be down on.
Like I said, daddy-o. Yeah. I don't think we're the target audience.
Brat, Barry. But I feel.
Oh, fam.
I also feel for the, the poor kids that they filmed shouting Wilshire and Hart and Tarkovsky, who were just on the cutting room floor because they didn't make the video.
That's showbiz.
They must have known they were hiding to nothing.
Yeah, probably.
Will there be a similar video for whoever is doing the pod during the World Cup?
I made a video. Because
that was rather more low key, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, weirdly, I was omitted from it. Is this something that I haven't been told yet?
Well, I only put Baz and then Barney dressed as a witch and then some other people. I don't know. What, have you got the hump? Like it's like a Touré birthday cake.
I blame David Moyes.
It is David Moyes' fault. We'll do a big announcement.
It should be like young people on a bus shouting Barney Roney. I mean, surely it's possible to do that.
Can we do that? I'll just take my phone onto the
just
top of the...
Just confuse
everyone. I'll get on the 63 and see how long I can do it without getting the shit being out of it. Could you just shout Glenn Denning? Oh, dear. That is England's World Cup squad. The sad news from yesterday of Ray Wilson, England's World Cup winning left-back, passing away at the age of 83. Was it Richard Williams wrote a nice piece on him in the paper yesterday? Yeah. He was the oldest player in Sir Alf Ramsey's starting 11. He spent most of his club career at Huddersfield Town, moved to Everton, where he helped them win the FA Cup in 1966. Crucial event in his career was being moved to left-back by Huddersfield's then-manager Bill Shankly. He'd just made half a dozen league appearances in the 55-56 season in Division 2. only 13 the season after. Then he became a regular of that team, made his debut for England against Scotland as a second division player in 1960. And after his career kept out of the limelight, made no attempt at making a living from football, either in punditry or management.
He worked as an undertaker.
He did, yeah. He pursued a career as an undertaker and was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2004. And absolutely tragic news about J. Lloyd Samuel as well. Died just 37 years old in a car crash in Cheshire. Played for England up until the under-21s, played for Trinidad and Tobago. I'm sure you've all seen, seemed totally loved by all the players that played with him at Bolton and Villa. Seemed very nice words from Kevin Davis and myriad others. So tragic news, gone way too soon. Other World Cup squad news. Manuel Neuer has made the preliminary Germany World Cup squad. Royce is in that as well. Premier League representatives Mustafi and Chan have missed out. No plays either for Mario Götze, who scored the winner in the 2014 final. Are we worried about how good Germany's squad is?
Well, I mean, I think we know it's really good. You know, they won the Confederations Cup with the reserve squad. They, you know, the changes they made to their academy system sort of 17, 18 years ago have had a phenomenal impact, and they have a lot of really, really good players.
No Andre Schürrle either, who set him up for that goal. It's sad, isn't it, when you do that? Well, I suppose they've had their fun, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know, you set up, scored the winner. You can retire then.
Yeah, but I also don't think you should be picking, certainly a country like Germany with the vast depth of quality they have, can't be picking people based on what they did 4 years ago.
How well would Germany be do?
Better than England.
Okay, that's good.
Is Miroslav Klose still there?
Wheel him out.
Neymar has made the Brazil squad, everyone.
Big news.
But Dani Alves hasn't.
His Corinthians Fagner has replaced him. And that video was nice of him finding out how he made the squad. Not watching people on buses in Brazil. He was hugging his family, and all his family were there in Brazil shirts.
But I think he's just coming back from injury himself, isn't he? Is that right? Did I see that properly? That he's, you know, he's only just sort of returned to fitness. So I think they've got problems at right back Brazil. Because, I mean, presumably Danilo's the next cap off rank after that.
Well, Edison, Danilo, Fernandinho and Jesus are among the Premier League-based players named in the squad. Firmino's in. Willian is in as well.
They only have six players from the 2014 squad left. David Luiz is out. Alexandro didn't make it. Fabinho was out. So
the BBC and ITV have named their lineups. Klinsmann, Drogba and Lampard join the BBC. Genev on ITVs. Who will you watch the final?
It's a good question, actually. I don't know.
Lineker or Pugac?
Don't know.
Oh. Wilson?
I'll be there.
Okay.
I assume I'll be there. I mean, I'd be annoyed if I weren't after spending a fortune.
I would rather watch the BBC, I suppose, because they don't have adverts, but it wouldn't be much in it beyond that.
Some adverts on some broadcasting channels are quite catchy, I think.
Any particular Gaviscon adverts spring to mind?
Oh, well, like, now you mentioned Gaviscon. I'm actually in negotiations with someone else at the moment, Barry. I'm not going to say now, but it's very funny.
I think I know who it is.
And no, not that. Another one as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, not Rennie, producer Jonathan. I'm a Gaviscon man. You'd never see me doing Pepto-Bismol. Also, FIFA are about to announce their plans for a 2014 Club World Cup because we need some more football in the summers.
And my understanding is, although I have to say my understanding is pretty hazy on this, that Atletico qualified for it last night.
Did they?
I think they're the first team qualified, yeah. Although I have to... Yeah, the whole thing's...
Do they even know?
But was it not going to be completely arbitrary? They're just going to pick some really big and wealthy teams that people have heard of? Or is there going to be an actual qualifying aspect to it?
I think it was having won things in the past and winning European or Libertadores trophies at certain stages.
Maybe it's like Eurovision. So that
Leicester are in.
Yeah. Some countries that get in Eurovision because they pay so much, like the UK, and then some actually qualify. So maybe it'll be like that. Anyway, what are FIFA doing? probably not going to be great, is it?
Yeah, well, yeah, a club World Cup run by FIFA, possibly funded by Saudi Arabia. That sounds like a great idea. I don't see what could go wrong there at all.
It's in the UAE this year.
Yes.
Will you be going, Jonathan?
No.
Barry?
It sounds awful. It sounds absolutely awful.
It's really confusing because, you know, you start off with, you know, some Oceanian team playing, I don't know, an Asian team or whatever, and they qualify to play an African team who qualified, you know. So you have all these rounds that aren't really quarterfinals and things, but they claim they are. And then it ends up with a European team beating a South American team in the final. It's all deeply uninteresting.
But this new thing, if it goes through, is quite a sea change in football because it's a really big deal and it's going to be a much bigger tournament. But the question is, the lack of transparency is extraordinary. Like, they've not actually said where the money's coming from, which is incredible.
Well,
like,
I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's Saudi soft power, isn't it?
Yeah, probably.
Which is itself
what it looks like it is. But the idea that we're trying to, the football family are being asked to vote on whether to implement a tournament to make lots of money without actually telling them where the money comes from. It's extraordinary. And it just says that this idea that FIFA is somehow less of an awful organisation now because Blatter's gone is completely farcical. Like, this is really bad.
But I also think players need some time off. You know, every other year they actually do need to go and spend 6 weeks in Dubai.
I don't care. What about me?
And Wilson needs some time off.
I don't want to miss another 3 or 4 weeks of my cricket season.
There's a possibility that if you work the whole time, people might start zoning out of your anecdotes. anyway, look, that'll do for part one. In part two, we will start in Lyon. Welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra part two. I hope you enjoyed part one. I can't give any promises as to the quality of part two. Before we get on to the Europa League final, the 22nd of May, i.e. Tuesday, next week, we're doing a live show. Barry, you're coming.
Good.
Jonathan, you're coming.
Yes.
It's literally, you'll have the night of your life. And you get to hug Barry afterwards and talk
to
him.
No, you don't.
Yeah, you do.
No, you don't. No hugs. No learning.
Hey, has Barry ever hugged you?
I mean, not that I remember, but
I've had one hug from Barry in my whole life.
Had you fallen over and scraped your knee or something? What was?
No, he came into the radio once when he thought the show was 3 hours, and I told him it was two. And he was so happy. So do come along, please. Tuesday night, Emmanuel Centre, between 5 and 10, and 200 tickets remaining.
Really?
Oh, no, I think we're doing okay. Obviously, I've no idea.
It's between 5 and 10. I
thought... It's a long show. Yeah, get your head on. Give us some of your anecdotes. Yeah, start with Beyonce. Yeah. Oh, for the wind and the rain. The Europa League final. Marseille 0, Atletico Madrid 3. Jonathan, you were there.
I was there.
You have a nice time?
It was all right, yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the game?
Well, Marseille had that very good chance early on for Valère Germain, which, you know, nice little bit of interchange between Payet and Tovin to the Premier League. I was going to say rejects, but Payet wasn't really a reject. Sort of misfits who seemed to make up the bulk of the Marseille squad. And once that chance had been missed, it was pretty comfortable for Atletico. Two goals from Griezmann. The first one after a terrible error from, well, a bad ball out from Mondanda.
Is that the worst? Oh, you think it was a goalkeeping error?
I think it was a mixture of a poor ball from Mondanda, and then the midfielder, whose name is Anguissa, Anguissa, miscontrols it. So I'd say it was 50-50 of the blame.
But I mean, he miscontrolled it so far. I mean, it was quite extraordinary.
But Mondanda did really. Fire the pass at him, but yeah, he should have controlled it.
And that's the problem when centre backs split. That as soon as that's happened, it's the easiest pass in the world from Gabby to set Griezmann through and simple finish.
His second finish was so.
Oh,
nice,
his second finish was beautiful. But again, it was Marseille's defence sort of falling apart. That Adil Rami and Jordan Amavi, suddenly just a huge hole appeared between them, and Griezmann ran on to Koke's pass, wasn't it? But yeah, lovely finish. Mitroglou hit the post late on, but I mean there wasn't really any sense of a mounting Marseille fight back, and then a really nice finish from, or a really nice move and finish from Gabby to make it 3.
You haven't mentioned Clinton and G's outside of the foot.
Yeah, that was extraordinary.
Maybe my highlight of the whole football season. If you haven't seen it, here, the ball's coming across goal from the left. Most footballers slash humans would have attempted to side foot it into the corner with their left foot. That wasn't a guarantee that he'd score. He went with the outside of his right foot, technically more difficult. Somehow contrived to curl it the other way, as if he was suddenly given one of those plastic footballs that reverse swings. It was just a moment of total joy for me. I don't know if anyone else loved it.
The ball went out sort of 12 yards up the touchline.
Mm.
It reminded me of when you press the wrong button at FIFA. Yeah, like you're going to shoot, but you press the cross button instead, and you sort of whack it off to the side for no reason. But I wonder, Jonathan, watching it on TV, it really felt like when Germain missed the chance, it's like, yeah, it's not going to be your night as in Marseille, because you, yeah. Was it like that in the stadium?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of hadn't... I mean, Marseille, I think, let's not pretend I watched Liga. I don't. But from what people who do watch Liga had said, Marseille have been very, very good for the last sort of month or so. And, you know, they're only a point behind Lyon. We could take the third Champions League qualifying slot. You look at Tovan's record this season, 22 goals, 11 assists. Ocampos, I think, has got 9 assists and half a dozen goals or something. So that three of Tovan, Ocampos and Payet are playing really well. But I sort of hadn't really expected them to do anything. And then suddenly there's that move, and the interplay between Payet and Tovan was really nice. You know, maybe they could do something here. But yeah, there was that sort of... there was probably 3-1 in Marseille fans, Atletico fans in the stadium, and you sort of sensed this sort of depression.
Because I think everyone knows, like, if you're playing Atleti, you get that sort of chance. Like, you have to put them away. Like, you're not going to get many of them.
Payet going off early was...
Yeah, I mean, he apparently was injured going into the game, and it was a bit of a risk to start him. But Germain, at the end, was in tears, and I think he felt pretty responsible. Anything we can miss a chance. It's not entirely fair, but
you wonder how much that affects you for the rest of the game.
Yeah, quite.
And you know that they often say that, don't they, about the greatest goal scorers that can miss a chance without thinking for the whole match,
like Bentner.
Like exactly. So it's the third Europa League win for Atletico, 2 for Diego Simeone. Is he going to stay there forever, Simeone? Because he's always mentioned, isn't he? But
well. He certainly was talking last night as a man who was intending to stay, and he was even talking about Griezmann staying, which I think is unlikely. I think that move to Barcelona is pretty nailed on. But you sort of think actually where, given he clearly identifies with Atletico, and he played for them twice. His sort of values and Atletico's values, I think, are pretty closely matched. It's a good fit. He's loved there. He clearly has an emotional attachment to the club. Where would he go where his style of football would be accepted? So PSG, for instance, wouldn't want him. You know, they want somebody who's going to play with swagger. And I think he has to play somewhere where he can be the underdog. And Atletico probably the biggest club where you can be the underdog.
Everton want that kind of football, don't they?
Well, yeah.
Here's a headline from L'Équipe. Excuse the pronunciation. Les clubs français et les finales de Coupe de l'Europe, une malédiction. And Raymond has been in touch saying, une malédiction is a curse.
Yeah.
Not sure of the specifics of a spell. Difficult to argue that it's another example of a witch's curse, Barry. French clubs in European finals.
Because they've lost 12 or 14, is that right?
Whatever the witch says.
Well, French clubs do tend to have a habit of bottling big matches in Europe. I don't think Marseille was any disgrace in them losing that game last night. Atletico are better than them and outplayed them. I wouldn't say, point to any supernatural forces or anything. I just think they were beaten by a better team.
5% witch's curse?
I mean, as Barney would tell you, Atletico's budget is roughly double that of Marseille.
Well, then I'm not sure why they even bothered playing the game. They should have just given the cup to Atletico Madrid.
In the playoffs, Fulham will face Aston Villa at Wembley for the most lucrative game in world football to join the best league in the world. Fulham beat Derby 2-0 at Craven Cottage to overturn that 1-0 deficit from the first leg. Ryan Sessegnon, Dennis Adoy send the Cottagers to Wembley. they have looked very good, Fulham, haven't they? I mean, and then they play nice attacking football, bringing in Mitrovic on loan and Matt Target as well. Very canny purchases. Do most people want them to win, Lars? Do you want them to win?
Well, I personally, just because it's a nice place to go to watch football, so I'd like to see them make them. They were so much better than Derby over the course of two games here that it would have been a travesty if they hadn't gone through. And, you know, on a completely subjective level, Craven Cottage is a lovely place to go and watch a bit of football. And I've had some nice dealings with Fulham in the past, so I'm hoping they go up.
Yeah, I mean, it's easier for me to get to than Villa. I don't really care. I think that, you know, the right...
It's quite a sort of, you know, this bit of the pod specifically just if you are a football journalist. And they're going to go to the games.
Having said that, yeah, going to Villa Park is a lot of fun as well. It can be when it's when the atmosphere
is
good.
And so. The point is they are the third and fourth best teams. You know, they're the two better teams. Where, you know, the better team went through in each of the two semi-finals. It's the right final, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, mm-hmm. and failing.
Derby have, you know, get to the playoffs. Quite often, you sort of fear for them that, you know,
which is curse.
This, well, could be aging squad as well. 7 on Monday, starting 11, were over 30.
I think there was a curse on the baseball ground.
Mm. Yes, there was. There was to do with not winning the FA Cup or something, wasn't it?
Do curses travel?
With their partner baseball club in decline, Derby County FC made the baseball ground a permanent home in 1895 and renamed it the baseball ground. A party of gypsies were forced to move, and legend has it that before leaving, they put a curse on the ground, preventing Derby County from winning the FA Cup. But, I mean, they did win the FA Cup in 1946.
So it wasn't that good a curse?
I mean, I guess 51 years is a pretty...
It's not bad.
Pretty long time.
Thanks for that information that probably people didn't know. Fulham will play Villa. Aston Villa 0, Middlesbrough 0. So Villa won 1-0 on aggregate. Steve Bruce targeting his fifth promotion. After the game, Tony Pulis very upset that that Sam Johnson wasn't sent off for a handball, where Mike Dean seemed to get the decision wrong, although there was a rule change 2 years ago where if you handle outside the box, if there's a covering defender, you don't necessarily get sent off. But it's hard to say that John Terry would have got back to get that ball. But it was 2 minutes from time.
Yeah, so. I don't think it'd make much difference.
Can Villa can beat Fulham, can't they, Barry?
Yeah, of course they can. They already have this season. It's I think Fulham beat them 2-0 at Craven Cottage and Villa won the return fixture 2-1, I think. You know, one-off playoff game, anything can happen at the risk of stating politically obvious, but I personally would fancy Fulham, but you know, I wouldn't be particularly surprised if Villa beat them.
We should mention, because at the start of the season, a lot was made of the Snodgrass Vortex, where Robert Snodgrass, you know, good players go somewhere and disappear without a trace. And he is no longer in the Snodgrass Vortex because he's doing...
Are you sure it was a Snodgrass Vortex rather than just being West Ham?
Well...
The West Ham Vortex.
This is Joe Hart in the...
Joe Hart fell straight into the Snodgrass Vortex.
Javier Hernandez.
He also did.
Classic Vortex.
Yeah.
So basically, the Snodgrass Vortex is West Ham.
We made a mistake at the start of the season describing it as the Snodgrass Vortex.
Is that a letter?
Actually, there's no such thing. So if you could go back and re-listen to all the pods from, I'd say, August through to October, just every time we say Snodgrass Vortex, just say West Ham, please. And well done, Alan Hutton, who's... for me, had gone into an even deeper vortex. man-marked Adame Traore out of both games. And it's technically quite difficult to do because Traore is definitely stronger, fitter, faster, better than Alan Hutton in every way. And it's obviously it's easier to defend than attack. But there you are, Jonathan. One for you.
Would you say that Traore fell into the Alan Hutton vortex?
Well, possibly.
Whatever that may be.
But celebrate some good defending there. Man marked him out of two games.
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say, a player that I just assumed he'd retired about 5 years ago. But fair play to him.
But that could be a thing. The Hutton vortex could be when a younger, faster and more talented player suddenly is marked out of the game by a player who's presumed to be rubbish but suddenly isn't. Like Norway, we played Portugal a few years back, and Cristiano Ronaldo was kept quiet by humble, nice guy Tom Hugley, who's a nice guy but maybe not the best fullback in the world. And he was right on top of Cristiano Ronaldo for 90 minutes, God bless him. So that Cristiano then disappeared into some kind of Alan Hutton vortex.
Did man marking happen a lot more years ago than it does now?
Yeah.
And it stopped happening, why?
Because everybody zonal marks now.
But you can zonal mark, presumably, but put one... If two players are completely taken out of the game, then the zonal marking will work for the rest of us, right?
Yeah, but if you've got a zonal marking structure that's predicated on having 10 outfield players and you give yourself only 9, you have to make adjustments, and that's harder. But, it's only sort of, I would say... I mean, mid-60s it comes in, I guess, universal in English football by sort of early 80s. But, teams used to man mark. I mean, when the formations matched up, so when you had a WM playing a WM, they were obvious. The right back marks the left winger. The right half marks the inside left. Man marking made sense, and it's only from the 60s when... This is actually something where Ray Wilson was hugely significant in English football was... He became a left back at a time when the role of a fullback changed quite radically, and he was part of that change. That the left back had been the fullbacks had been very defensive players, and with the switch to a back four, which sort of comes into the late '50s, early '60s, they have to begin attacking, and he was a very effective early attacking fullback. From the '60s onwards, shapes don't necessarily match up, and that's when you have to pretty much go to a zonal system.
But now there are quite often formations match up. But you have your man, but that's different to man marking someone.
Yeah, because you pick up whoever comes in your zone. And if you're pressing, which all teams do now, vast majority of teams do now, then you can't press you can press and man mark, but it's complicated and it's easy to do it by zonal marking.
And I guess you only really want to man mark the best players. And with respect to Traore, he's not Messi, so if you man mark Messi and he beats you, then you're beaten.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like I understand. League One, Rotherham 2, Scunthorpe 0. They'll play Shrewsbury in the playoff final. Goals from Richard Wood and Will Volks sent Rotherham through. They beat Leyton Orient in 2014 in the same final. Scunthorpe had a lot of chances in this game. And I don't know if anybody saw the Scunthorpe skipper, Rory McArdle's two yellow cards. His first yellow card was... It was sort of De Jong style kung fu. It was mistimed. It wasn't intentional, but the player nipped the ball past him and then basically, from his point of view, just saw a flying boot come into his chest. And then the commentary was just, yeah, it looks like a yellow to me. And it was staggering that no one complained more. They complained a bit, but he could have gone for that. He then tried another one and completely missed everything, but he got his second yellow. In League Two, Exeter Lincoln is tonight. Goalless from the first leg. Notts County play Coventry tomorrow. 1-1 on aggregate. We will end part two there and begin part three talking about Sam Allardyce and David Moyes. Welcome to part three of Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Premier League... managers getting sacked a lot. Sam Allardyce has gone. We can talk to our Merseyside correspondent, Andy Hunter. Andy, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Yourself?
Very good, thanks. Enjoyed your piece in the paper today, Andy. You weren't entirely complimentary about Sam's reign at Goodison.
No, there's nothing to be complimentary about, to be honest, apart from him improving Everton's defensive organisation, which you would expect from him, and probably expect a bit more for the money he's got for 6 months' work. But no, nothing to be complimentary about, and no surprise that he's gone, and probably shouldn't have been, well, no, no probably about it, shouldn't have been appointed in the first place.
He did what he was asked to do, didn't he? They were 13th, 5 points off the relegation zone. They finished 8th. He's got the same points per game record as Sean Dyche.
Yeah. He inherited a decent individual players that he had to bring some organisation to. The football was absolutely dreadful. Didn't endear himself to the fans in any way whatsoever. He gave no impression that he was invested in the long-term future of Everton. He gave no reason for fans to be optimistic looking ahead. Yes, he did what he had to do. I don't think they were in that serious danger, to be honest, in the first place. I mean, and I think it suits Allardyce now to say what a, you know, what an absolute mess he inherited and that type of thing. But I would accept that the defensive record in the weeks prior to his appointment was appalling. I don't think they'd have been in much worse state if they'd have stuck with Koeman, or perhaps even they'd be given Unsworth longer, although that was a risk, and I think something had to be done about that. But I think you go back to the problem was sacking Koeman without a better replacement in the bag. I just think it was a terrible mistake, and a very clumsy process led to Allardyce eventually being given the job after 5 or 6 weeks. And given the length of time it took Fahad Moshiri to actually offer Allardyce the job after the initial contact, I think he came in knowing that he was only going to be a short-term appointment, and so he was kind of up against it in that respect from day one.
Andy, Allardyce apologists, and there are quite a few writing in the papers today, would say that Everton fans are delusional, that they're looking, you know, they should be grateful that the great man deigned them with their presence. Is there any argument at all to be made for that?
No, but it's kind of what happens when Sam Allardyce leaves the job. He has a lot of friends in the media, most of whom I wouldn't say have even watched or attended an Everton game since he's been in charge. It's to be expected. I think it's part of the whole boring, predictable cycle that goes around managers like him. Why shouldn't Everton fans have some optimism, I mean, or some hope looking forward, or to see some semblance? And he had long enough, you know, Everton was safe by Christmas. He had long enough to try and even suggest that there was more to him than, you know, the reputation that he hates. But basically, it just confirmed that the reputation is true. Everton fans, not just because of the money they spent last summer, but, you know, for what the club is. I mean, the club might not be finishing anywhere higher than seventh in the foreseeable future, but you've got to have some hope or optimism that they will try and they will have a go, and they could entertain the fans who, you know, sell out every single away game that they go to, and are not, you know, expecting them to suddenly be Champions League qualifiers because they've spent and wasted a fortune. But to have some sort of optimism, to see something that is developing at Everton, to see someone who's actually looking to the long term. I mean, basically, Allardyce gave the players several days off before the last game of the season. So I don't think he ever gave the impression that he was the man for, you know, the long term anyway. But where they go now, but what I would say in Allardyce's,
you can't bring yourself to say defence, can you?
You know, is that basically he's not the start and finish of Everton's problems. Everton are a badly run club at the moment, with poor appointments, terrible recruitment, and I think that's been recognised. You know, Moshiri's not going to come out and say that, but his actions this week back that up, in that he's replaced the director of football, the chief execs going anyway. He restructured the whole executive board because, in recognition that things are not going well, not just on the pitch, but off the behind the scenes, the club is not run well. And I think he is kind of belatedly getting to grips with that.
Marco Silva, do we presume he'll get the job?
Yeah, I would say so. I think Moshiri's been set on him since Koeman was sacked at the end of October. And I think the process is already underway of trying to iron out whatever legal problems or compensation issues there are with Watford and getting him in as quickly as possible. But then again, it's another risk. I think I've just done some calculations, and I think Marcus Silva, over his time at Hull and Watford, has presided over 13 Premier League wins. So it's another risk, but then every managerial appointment is. But I think whoever they appoint, they've just got to, you know, give them time and not, you know, waver again if he has another, you know, 9-10 game bad run. But at least if, I would say on the flip side, as long as they can see that there's some sort of identity to the team under whoever the next manager is, because there certainly wasn't one under Sam Allardyce.
Andy, thanks for your time.
No problem at all. Cheers, mate.
Take it easy. Andy Hunter, Merseyside correspondent. I did play blockbusters with Big Sam once, and he was great. So, you know, you win some, you lose some.
I couldn't disagree with the thing Andy wrote in his article. It was quite savage, but I do think that if Sam Allardyce hadn't got the England job and stayed at Sunderland, they would not be in League One now. They'd probably still be in the Premier League.
David Moyes has been sacked by West Ham. 9 wins and 10 draws from 31 games as West Ham boss. Jonathan, is he more unlucky than Sam Allardyce?
Yes. Sam Allardyce was a better manager of Sunderland, but I think David Moyes had a better season. He came into a really difficult situation, I think, where relegation was a very present threat for West Ham in a way. You always sort of expected Everton to get out of it. He took them up the table. Pretty quickly he eased those fears. He got Arnautovic playing as well as he's played in the Premier League. And with all the nonsense going on off the pitch there, I think he did as good a job as anybody realistically could have done. Having said that, I completely understand why West Ham think they want to get somebody a bit more exciting, younger, fresher, more exotic.
Rafa Benitez is trending.
Rafa Benitez is an excellent manager.
Would he go from Newcastle, where he's totally loved, to West Ham?
Good question.
Where there are so many problems.
I don't understand why. Well,
there are problems at Newcastle, sure, but at least he knows what they are.
I can see why he would use it to try and force more money out of Mike Ashley. And with my Sunderland hat on, I would love him to leave Newcastle, because I think he's a very good thing for Newcastle. But it would seem a strange move for him. I mean, you also sort of just feel that Newcastle's, the upper ceiling of their realistic expectations is higher than that of West Ham. And maybe that changes if the new stadium for West Ham becomes a positive thing. But Newcastle, 50,000 capacity, a club that feels like it's underachieved for 93 years. I take no pleasure in
that. Hey, Claudio Ranieri's just left Nantes, so he could be at the London Stadium.
But is there not a wider point here with both of these sackings that, more than ever before, because football is so stratified, you know, if you support a team that's not in top six, you're not probably not going to win anything. You're not going to win the league. If you do have a slightly better season than usual and sort of sniff around the Champions League places, your best players will probably leave the summer after. So it's kind of a desperate existence, really. And that means it's more important than ever that you have a team that you at least look forward to watching at the weekend. And that doesn't mean they have to play like Pep's Barcelona, but there needs to be something there to entertain you, and you need to feel that the club represents you on the pitch by the way they go about things in some way.
But I think Everton are an unusual case. I think that's absolutely true of Everton, because I don't, if Everton got relegated, it would take such a horrendous series of bad things to happen. Their resources are such they should be seventh. And a bad season then should be sort of 10th or 11th. And so then the quality of a spectacle becomes more important. And that maybe is why Allardyce seemed such a good fit for Sunderland, where clinging on, desperately surviving was pretty much all we ever did. Yeah. I don't know, Sunderland historically have never really bothered themselves.
What's the Sunderland way?
Whack it up to Quinny.
Take
some really nice Victorian buildings and put some shitty concrete frontage on them and turn them into terrible clubs.
Yeah, slightly contrary to what I just said, you can make a strong case that with all the weirdness going on around West Ham, just having a solid and unspectacular David Moyes in charge for a couple of years, where you probably won't get relegated, maybe not the worst thing in the world. But I can understand fans wanting, they don't really have hope as such, so at least you need to look forward to stuff in the short term.
And
modern football.
Before we cry too many salty tears for Big Sam, you know, let's face it, how much money has he got this time?
I think he gets. I think he got $6 million while he was there, wow, and six payoff. I so think
for 6 months' work, $12 million.
Yeah,
that's not bad.
Uh-huh. Oh.
I mean, and the thing is, Moyes technically wasn't sacked. His contract was up. So I feel a bit sorry for him because he doesn't get 12 million quid for doing nothing.
I mean, really, if we'd gone into Everton, right, the four of us, I bet we wouldn't have gone down.
No. Well,
yeah.
We'd be a big rouse about whether to play Sigurdsson or Rooney. I mean,
oh, that's not a debate, surely. I mean, just Sigurdsson, right? Until he got injured.
Yeah, but you've got to understand the club, Jonathan.
Well, I think if there was some sort of rota where Jonathan did the tactics.
I want to get out of that pitch. No, let me do the banter.
Yeah.
No, that's a terrible idea.
Jonathan did the tactics. Max dealt with the players and Barry dealt with the media. And I think
Barry should be bad cop, shouldn't he? Like, if I need somebody to give a player kick up the, you know.
And that would be awful because it would take ages.
And I wouldn't be able to be bad cop because I wouldn't. I'd just laugh all the time.
Okay, well, yeah, maybe we would have gone down. Mikel Arteta said to me, named the Arsenal manager. I mean, I don't know how true this is. They're just saying he's having talks today, apparently, and Arsenal giving him £50 million to spend. I'm not sure if that's enough money for Arsenal, really, to not be sixth.
Well, I presume he'll be able to sell a few, get rid of a few players and make a few quid out of that. But, yeah, £50 million, one would even buy you left back these days, would it?
No, it wouldn't. Wenger's been banging a familiar drum on Arsenal.com. First part of a final interview series he's given to the club website. Quote, the obvious player Arsenal missed out on that comes to mind is Ronaldo. He was here with his mother and we were very close. I met Cesc Fabregas' parents at the time and we were interested in Messi and Piqué as well.
Stop saying.
We tried for the three, but of course it didn't work out because of the agents. With Messi, Barcelona didn't want to lose him, of course, and they made the offer that was needed to keep the player at the club. Here we are. But you got Chris Kiwom, yeah? It's all right. Gigi Buffon's announced at a press conference he's to play his final game for Juve on Saturday. Stopped short of announcing his retirement, with rumours of Liverpool, apparently, sniffing around him. He said, up until 15 days ago, it was certain and well known that I would stop playing, but now I've received some proposals and exciting challenges, both on the field and off it.
Can I interject with some live reaction from the German squad decisions here now?
Of course.
Because Sandro Wagner, as you might know, is quite a headstrong young man. Well, he's not that young anymore. When he scored his first competitive goal for Bayern a couple of months ago, he immediately declared himself to be the best German striker. He said, in my eyes, I am the best German striker. Which is statistically untrue, but he then followed that up by, and without relying on statistics, says, I couldn't care less about those. Now, he was dropped from the squad or just not included in the squad, and he's told Bild now, I resign from the national team. It is clear that my open, honest nature doesn't fit with the coaching staff. So he's not been selected, and he has now resigned from the national team. No more Sandro Wagner.
Interesting. It's the FA Cup final this weekend, everybody. Chelsea versus Manchester United. Conte versus Mourinho. How excited are you?
Funnily enough, I don't think I've ever been less enthused about an FA Cup final since I became aware of the existence of the FA Cup. Yeah.
What about Portsmouth Cardiff?
Yeah, I was up for that because it was Portsmouth Cardiff.
That was on Norway Day, so I mean, I remember watching it on Norway Day after doing a big parade, thinking that, you know, this is all right.
I will, of course, watch it. I always do watch the FA Cup, but yeah, I'm not enthused about it at all for some weird reason. Maybe it's because I think neither of the clubs involved are that particularly enthused about it, or if they are, they're hiding it well. But it just seems to be a bit of an afterthought for some reason this season. I'm not sure why.
I'm actually leaving the country. That's how intrigued I am. Between that and the royal wedding, like, this weekend, I can't deal with this.
Jonathan, which are you going to watch, the cup final or the royal wedding?
The cup final.
Okay.
Well, last time was a royal wedding. I went to Albania to get away from it. Mm. And
which was that one? William.
Yeah.
Okay. I went to Copenhagen, I think, to get away from it.
But I was getting a bus from Duresh to Vlora, I think, and the bus was delayed. So I thought, oh, I'll just get a taxi. You know, it's Albania, it's dirt cheap. And the driver realising I was English, insisted on having the Albanian coverage of a wedding on the radio. So just every now and again you'd hear, Duke of Cambridge, blah, 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 William, blah, 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 Prince Philip.
I'm going to Naples because I booked some really cheap flights when they looked like they might win the league, and now they're not winning the league, but still go on, because why wouldn't you?
I hate to bring it back to football, but this could be Eden Hazard's last game for Chelsea. I wonder if Chelsea fans are starting to fear what might happen next season, because Conte probably won't be there. They're not in the Champions League. They've got this issue with the stadium, which actually could be, you know, a total disaster. Does anybody share this fear with me? Or
no, I think you're absolutely right. And it would be, it'd be terrible for Chelsea. But it would be kind of funny if a Fulham chairman, like, given how Fulham have existed in Chelsea's shadow for so long, if they stitched them up like that, I would smile a smile. Weird how Chelsea have... last season, that 3-4-2-1, all you could see was the positive stuff. All you could see was how Azar and Pedro were very difficult to pick up. And Chelsea, I think they lost United in the league in April last season, so towards the end of the season after the title was pretty much wrapped up. But they beat them convincingly in the league, they beat them convincingly in the FA Cup last season. And you sort of thought, yeah, this Chelsea system will beat United. There's no way for United to respond. And this season, without anything much changing, it feels like the complete opposite, that United's three in midfield will put pressure on Kante and Fabregas, and you don't really trust Chelsea's pressing to get them through that, which is last season you would have done. And last season you'd have said, well, the difficulty is going to be United's wide players picking up the Chelsea wing-backs, and now it's the other way around, that you just don't trust the Chelsea press to get them high enough up the pitch. You sort of think that Alonso and Moses are going to have to sit deep to stop Sanchez and Lingard getting in behind them. And that then means that Azar and Willian are going to have to defend. And Willian, I think, is okay at that, but Azar isn't. So, Chelsea's decline.
Is it going to be a good game?
That kind of depends on Jose, doesn't it?
You could get an early goal either way. It could make it kind of interesting.
The game at Old Trafford was pretty entertaining, I thought. Yeah. Both sides were, I thought, surprisingly attacking that day. Chelsea ended up being, although they took the lead, they were pretty comfortably beaten in the end, but I thought that was a perfectly engaging game. United have won their last seven games at Wembley when it's been a neutral venue. And Jesse Lingard scored three times in four appearances there, I think. League Cup final, FA Cup final, and Community Shield.
Does it not, at the end of the day, just come down to Mourinho's quite excellent record in finals? Like, he's just really, really good at getting the job done somehow, and you feel like against a fairly unconvincing Chelsea team, he's going to do it again, surely.
Yeah, I would think United would win it, yeah.
I was really hoping you were going to say it just comes down to who wants it more.
It really doesn't.
Chelsea ladies secure the League and Cup double. They needed a point at Bristol City on Tuesday to seal the Women's Super League title with a game to spare. Manager Emma Hayes watched from the sofa. She is 35 weeks pregnant with twins. She's done such a brilliant job. She's a fantastic manager. Brilliant talk about the game as well. A bit of rebuilding to do when she returns. Katie Chapman, the captain's leaving. Enia Luko moves on as well. And Claire Rafferty departs after 10 years. But congratulations to Chelsea ladies and Emma Hayes. Just a couple of questions. Gareth says, how do you work out the hypotenuse of a right-angle triangle?
It's the sum of... Well, I know how you work out the square of it.
Okay.
It's the sum of the squares of the other two sides.
And then what do you do?
That's it.
Square root it, don't you?
Then you square root it, yeah. Very good. More maths questions, please. Ed on Feedback Corner, the replacement for a cold, wet Tuesday night in Stoke, we established that we couldn't have one, should be Selhurst Park under the lights. Palace are not substantially better at night, but it does get trotted out on a very regular basis. And that's a fair point to Ed makes.
Yeah, the difference is that, and I mean no disrespect to the city of Stoke when I say this, if it is a city, which I'm not convinced it is, if that's not. But There is no place that's been in the Premier League, I would suggest, since the Premier League began in 1992, with such a poor selection of hotel rooms. They are awful hotels in Stoke. I've never seen anywhere good there. And that's an issue on an evening game, because on a Saturday you can get the train back. Whereas Crystal Palace, I can go to my flat.
I've revised my opinion on the cup final, and I don't think it'll come down to Jose. I think it'll come down to who has the biggest box of tricks and who can put the opposing fullback into a box and pull out a chicken to confuse the rest of them. And that will decide it.
What did you have for breakfast?
Well, it's kind of boring today, so maybe I shouldn't say it.
Hey, thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lars.
Norway Day.
Thanks, Jonathan.
I had a toasty de jambon et fromage at the Starbucks. It was the only thing open at Lyon Airport at 5 o'clock this morning, 4 o'clock your time. And the woman heated it, and it was still cold on the inside, but my French was not good enough to explain this, so I just put up with it. Goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.